Whether or not you're into history, if you care about bravery, wisdom, passion, larger-than-life characters, and some of the most emotionally intense moments in human experience, you've come to the right place. Daniele Bolelli is a university history professor, writer, and martial artist, and he shall be your guide in a journey to the place where history and epic collide.
Welcome to episode 32 of History on Fire. This episode is actually going to be divided in a part A and part B. Part B is going to release just 24 hours later, so by the time most of you guys hear this, it will be already be out. But just so you know, this episode is separated in two different files. For a simple reason, this episode is a little different from what we normally do, in the sense that there's a compare and contrast between two historical events, and I cover one of them in this episode. And then my friend and amazing podcast, Daryl Cooper, did the second part of the episode in part B. After that, we're going to then get together and record the next episode, episode 33, which will be where we draw the conclusions from some of the stories that we highlight. Both of them are, you know, if we were to pack everything in one episode, which was the original plan, it may have been too long. So this is the way we do this. So keep an eye out also for the second half of episode 32 coming up tomorrow. In the meantime, couple of things. If you guys want to get, you want to support the show, there's always the option of checking out the Patreon page for History on Fire. I'll have the links in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. If you guys are interested and want to donate, there are a few perks that come with it. It would be very appreciated. Also, I want to say a big thank you to the people sponsoring the show today. Support for this podcast comes from the new CNN original series, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History. This dramatic new six-part series is narrated by Liam Neeson and links recent news events surrounding the Vatican to their unexpected historical origins in the Catholic Church. From the start of the papacy, to struggles with corruption, to the impossible challenges faced by wartime popes, go inside the Vatican to explore the roles of popes throughout history and how they spread Catholicism around the world. This series is going to premiere on Sunday, March 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. So again, that's Sunday, March 11th at 10 p.m. I'm really looking forward to it because A, I'm planning an episode coming up which will at least marginally have to do with the papacy. So that intrigues me. Plus, I mean, when you look at the whole history of the papacy, there's so much wild thing. There are so many things that they kind of defy the imagination. There are stories that one would hardly even believe they are true until you check them out. So it's really fascinating topic to me. I can't wait to see what this series will uncover. And I'm fairly sure that I'm going to be using some of the material for future episodes at some point. I would also like to give a big shout out to the sweet folks at Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the leading meal kit delivery service in the US. But that's not saying enough, to my opinion. I could tell you about all the different amazing recipes that they offer, but I think the easiest thing to do is for you to go check them out on their website. Take a look at the incredible variety and high quality of the different recipes. And that way, there's no filter. You find out for yourself what all those things are. I'm not going to spend time reading every single one of the recipes that have graced my table and ended up in my stomach. There are way too many to talk about, and all of them equally good. I would feel bad to just pick one over the other. Tomorrow, or rather what will be tomorrow for me, you guys, by the time you hear this, it may be in the past, but tomorrow is the day when I'm going to receive some Blue Apron meals. Savannah M., the producer and editor of History on Fire, is by now, you know, a week has gone by since the last delivery, so she's wandering the house with hollow eyes and, you know, going like, when is it coming? When is it coming? Come on, I want my Blue Apron. You know, her addiction to Blue Apron is reaching, sincerely, some scary levels. I have to say, I understand, because it is really that good. So check it out. Blue Apron is treating History on Fire listener to $30 off your first order if you visit blueapron.com/onfire. So check out this week's menu and get your $30 off at blueapron.com/onfire. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And of course, big, big, big thank you to my regular sponsors, Onnit and Datsusara. Onnit just sent me, among the many products that they carry, they just sent for both me and Savannah to use this awesome... They are like weights to put on the barbells, so you know, it's like seem like fairly regular stuff, but they struck this deal with Marvel Comics, so the weights are painted and shaped exactly like the Captain America shield. They're awesome. So I've been lifting this past week and been very happy with it. Plus, all their supplements. You know, if you have never tried Alpha Brain, I strongly recommend it. I believe, I'm not sure if they still have the same policy regarding returns. I remember they had a very generous policy about it. If you just want to try and find out if it's for you. Personally, I love it, particularly Alpha Brain in powder form. So check them out. They are great. And of course, Datsusara. If you're even thinking of buying a bag, a travel bag, a backpack, and, you know, those are the main items, but there's so many other things on the Datsusara website at dsgear.com. Everything handmade with the highest quality. Check them out. I use them all the time. Love them. All the links for all of these products are in the episode notes. So go take a look and find out for yourself why I rave so and speak so highly about these companies. Having said all that, I'll shut up for now so that we can get the episode going. So now, without further ado, let's go set history on fire. Since I like you guys, I will properly warn you. This is not the kind of episode you want to listen to with your kids, for sure. This is also not the kind of episode you want to listen to before going on a hot date. It will not help with the mood. This is not the kind of episode for light-hearted listening. This is going to be heavy. The great Darryl Cooper, who, as I will soon explain, will cooperate with me for this episode and the next, texted me as he was researching for the half of the story that he'll be covering today. His exact test was, how hard am I allowed to go in this episode? This is getting dark. And my text back to him was a quote from the Simon and Garfunkel's The Sound of Silence. I replied, "Hello darkness, my old friend." Yeah, and this is going to be darker than anything I've done on History on Fire so far, and hopefully anything that I'll do going forward. But there's a reason why I want to cover this. I don't like looking at horrible, brutal stories like the ones we'll play with here, due to some pathological fascination with blood and gore. I want to do this because of what they reveal about human nature, about good and evil, and about how individuals can choose to be a source of light even in the middle of the deepest darkness. So having said that, let me explain what we'll do in this two-part series. In this episode, I partner up with my friend and podcast master Darryl Cooper. Daryl, if you don't know him, is a mad genius. His podcasting skills are, in my opinion, second to none. His series on the genesis of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one of the greatest history podcast series ever recorded. And you may remember Daryl since he produced three episodes as companions to the Conquest of Mexico series I did a while back. So today, Daryl and I will tell you two eerily similar stories. I will cover the tale of the Sand Creek Massacre from 1864, and Daryl will tell you the story of the My Lai Massacre from 1968. For complicated reasons that I won't bother you with, we have chosen to break up this episode in two separate audio files, so this particular file you'll be listening to will contain my part of the story. Tomorrow, assuming you're listening to this on the very first day it's released, we'll have the second half of this episode in which Daryl will take over and I will be all him. So check it out. Again, keep in mind this is one episode that is part A and part B, and then there will be a completely separate episode in this series released about a month from now, which is where we'll draw some of the conclusions from the tales that we'll tell you about today. It would be nice to think that stories like the ones we'll tell you today are exceptions in an otherwise spotless historical record. Unfortunately, they aren't. Human history is littered with massacres, and we could have picked any of them to do a show on. You know, if we wanted to draw some conclusions about human natures in general, any massacre would have done. There are a couple of reasons why we pick this particular two. For one, they are more recent. You know, one is from 1968, one is from the late 1800s, so more recent means it's easier for people to relate. The other factor is that both of them involve American soldiers. Now, let me clear this up right away, because I know otherwise people may spin this the wrong way. Yes, the monsters in both stories are American soldiers. But no, this episode is not designed to bash American troops. I repeat, this episode is not designed to bash American troops. It's useful to remember that some of the key heroes in both stories are also American soldiers. So this is not a pro or against American soldier thing. But then, yeah, why did we pick stories that involve American soldiers? Well, while our listeners come from across the globe, the bulk comes from the United States. You know, if the bulk of my listeners came from Germany, I would have used examples from Nazism. If the bulk of my listeners came from Japan, I would have used stories from the Rape of Nanking. If the bulk of my listeners came from Rwanda, I would have used example from the Rwanda genocide. You know, there are horrific episodes in the history of pretty much every country on Earth. But the bulk of my listeners come from the United States. And this is why I pick these examples, because it's important to understand that horror is always closer than we like to acknowledge. And there are always ways in which people rationalize it. You know, due to some misguided sense of allegiance, people seem to have an easy time identifying horror when it's perpetrated by people they don't identify with. But they often find ways to rationalize it away if it's perpetrated by people they view as their team. You know, a while back, I remember I was on Facebook, on my public Facebook page, posting some History on Fire related stuff, and I was discussing Nazi atrocities, then I mentioned some stories, horrible stories from the Soviet Union, and a few other cases, and almost everybody responded with indignation and disgusted by what happened in these cases, and the standard explanation sounded like, yes, of course, because those guys are evil freaks. And then I brought up the My Lai Massacre, and suddenly the very same people were outraged when atrocities were committed by people from different countries, were rushing to find excuses. You know, you must understand, they were under tremendous pressure, They had seen some of their friends got killed, you know, the enemy had done horrible things to them. And I'm not even arguing that that's incorrect. Many of these points are actually right, but where was all this rush to understanding when atrocities were committed by people wearing the uniform of a different country? And this is exactly the problem. Every monster in the world can come up with some justification for their behavior. Reality is, there are things for which there is no justification. I don't care what pressure you're under or what horrible things you have endured. When you start bashing the skulls of babies or raping defenseless people, none of that matters. You know? So these particular examples allow us to stare at the beast in the eyes and see if blind allegiance to nationalism and group identity may make us perceive horror in a different light, or if we have the guts to call horror for what it is. There are also eerie parallels in these two stories. They are almost exactly 100 years apart, 140 years to be correct. In both cases, some of the soldiers involved either stopped the massacre or refused to participate. And in both cases, these guys were really the true heroes of these stories, faced major backlash for it. So again, these are just examples, but these are examples that will serve us in part two as evidence for us to start a discussion about psychology, about human nature, about good and evil, about individual agency, about a lot of things that are key to understanding life. So with that clear and out of the way, let me get rolling with my half of the episode. And then when I'll be done with my story, Daryl will take over for his half of the episode. The story that I will cover takes place shortly after the midpoint of the 1800s in the American West. I've mentioned briefly this story when I think it was during the Crazy Horse series, if I remember correctly. It's either during the Crazy Horse series or during the War for the Black Hills one. I believe it was the Crazy Horse series. But that was, you know, fairly a fast overview of this topic. Now we're going to get deep into this one. So we go back to 1849 with the discovery of gold in California. For the first time, this event brought mass numbers of American settlers through the Great Plains. And I've discussed life on the Great Plains in the 1800s, both in the Crazy Horse series and in the War for the Black Hills series. But to catch you up in a few seconds on at least the basic things, if you haven't listened to some of those episodes, the Native American tribes on the Great Plains were primarily nomadic buffalo hunters, living in teepees and following the bison herds. Many of these guys used to live further east, but they got pushed onto the plains as Americans conquered their lands there. And by the 1700s, as horses were becoming widely available, lots of these people transformed their lives and morphed into full-time buffalo hunters. When all these Americans started traveling through, the United States government wanted to make a deal with the tribes, to ensure that they would not molest their settlers, they would let American people travel through. So they gathered together at Fort Laramie, and in 1851 they convinced many of the tribes to sign a treaty. And the tribes basically said, yeah, it's fine, we'll let these people through. As long as they don't stop and take over our land, they can go to California and pass through our lands, no big deal. The problem was that as you know, while the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty was well-intentioned, vast numbers of settlers traveling through the Great Plains started scaring off the bison herds, changing their migratory patterns, using up precious resources, bringing diseases. The Cheyenne tribe, which will be central to our story today, for example, had been severely weakened by several epidemics that killed quite a high percentage of them, and this was as a result of contact with American settlers traveling through. As far as the Cheyenne and another allied tribe to them, the Arapaho, the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty had acknowledged that these two tribes owned most of eastern Colorado and some land as well is western Kansas, southeastern Wyoming, southwestern Nebraska. So far so good, and it worked for a few years. The problems began when, in the winter between 1858 and 1859, gold was discovered in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. And so now people were not just traveling to go to California, they were also beginning to invade Cheyenne and Arapaho lands. Modern cities like Denver or Boulder in Colorado, they began as mining camps and eventually developed into cities. Now, of course, once you pile up enough Euro-Americans onto lands that the tribes claim for themselves, it was really only a matter of time before trouble would rear its ugly head. There were a few isolated incidents during the 1850s. There's a few thefts and murders back and forth. For the most part, considering the close proximity between the two populations, wasn't that bad. Both sides were pretty mellow in the early days, but, you know, obviously there was tension. In 1860, a group of drunken inhabitants of Denver visited a nearby Arapaho village while most of the men were out, dragged out several women out of their teepees and raped them. The leader of the group was a certain Charles Gardner, aka Big Phil the Cannibal. In case you're wondering how does someone end up stuck with a nickname like that, wonder no further. The story is pretty straightforward. Big Phil once ate a traveling companion while they were stuck in a storm, hence Big Phil the Cannibal. This story, the one I mentioned about the Arapaho village, this is how often things begin. Someone awful from Group A does something despicable. Someone awful from Group B does also something despicable. But due to very misguided sense of group identity, the people from Group A will blame all the people from Group B for actions done by a terrible human, and vice versa. So sometimes, such as in this case, restraint prevails. Like in the story of the Arapaho village, nothing happened afterwards. But eventually, it's only a matter of time before more ordinary members for Group B will retaliate against somebody from Group A, either somebody guilty or completely innocent, they just happen to belong to Group A. And this is what usually begins the pattern of retaliations back and forth. Almost invariably works like this. In this specific story, the root problem was the taking of the land, of the taking of Cheyenne and Arapaho land, without making any realistic plans for the two cultures, for Americans coming in and the Cheyenne and Arapaho live there. There really was no plan for them to coexist, for how to make it work. The fact that so many settlers were coming into Colorado pressured the government to start figuring out ways to take more and more Indian land. So in 1861, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, who was the highest government job dealing with the bureaucracy overseeing relationship with Indian tribes, was sent to negotiate a new treaty. At the Treaty of Fort Wise, signed in 1861, a few chiefs, not that many, a few of them from the Cheyenne and Arapaho, agreed to give up most of their lands. There were 6 Cheyenne leaders and 4 Arapahos, including among the Cheyenne there was a certain Black Kettle, whose name you may want to remember. Now, these guys basically signed off on giving away over 90% of their land base and saying they were willing to settle on a reservation in eastern Colorado. As usual, most of them really didn't know what they were signing. They didn't speak English, they definitely didn't read it, so they were told some story, and most of them, all they understood was that this was a treaty for peace, and they were signing essentially a deal that would make sure that the United States and the Cheyenne and the Arapaho would be at peace. That's what they understood, so they didn't quite get the fact that they were giving up 90% of their land or stuff like that. Many of the Cheyenne who had not signed, which is the vast majority of the tribe, were enraged by this decision. You know, the treaty was never approved by the Council of 44, which was the main political governing body for the Cheyenne tribe, which was made up of 44 leaders from the various bands of the tribe. So this guy said those few chiefs had no authorization, and on top of it, they had not understood that the terms were highly unfavorable within the treaty. So as a Cheyenne nation or Arapaho nation, they refused to stick to it. The governor of Colorado, on the other hand, saw it as the treaty's done, so now we have a legal right to take all your land. John Evans became governor of Colorado in 1862. He was, he's going to be a key character in our story. He was very much against slavery, but as progressive as he may have been in that regard for the times, he was a firm believer in the notion that American Indians had no soul. He wanted to bring the railroad through Colorado, and he saw American Indians only as obstacles to civilization. You know? He brings this particular attitude toward native people at a time when the encounters between Americans and the Cheyenne are getting more heated, and the situation very much would require a supremely delicate touch. And it's safe to say that Evans was not the man for it. He was the proverbial bull in a china shop. He did not have that delicate touch. Now, the tension keeps increasing in 1863. And the origin of the problem was that the reservation assigned to the Cheyenne and the Arapaho was way too close to the lands occupied by white Americans. The government had made not enough provisions for, you know, if you're taking away all this land, these guys are losing much of their livelihood, you at least have to make up with some food. There really wasn't enough food. All the best land had been taken. So, of course, these result in some upset. Cheyenne and Arapaho are going to start retaliating by stealing cows or things like that, which cause a counter-retaliation. So, you know, when you have these people thrown on a reservation starving, doesn't take a genius to figure out that things could turn ugly quickly. You know, the agent Samuel Colley wrote, "Most of the depredations committed by them," meaning the Cheyenne, "are from starvation." Similarly, the Special Agent for Indian Affairs, H.T. Ketchum, said that the Cheyenne were regularly getting cheated by traders and taken advantage at every turn, and on top of it, there was not enough food on the small reservation. So he also said, "You cannot expect to have any permanent peace with these Indians." Because, of course, you know, given the conditions, there was no way that peace was going to prevail. Often, whenever the Cheyenne were found outside of the boundaries of the 1861 treaty, which most of the tribe didn't acknowledge, they could be attacked. So, again, more problems piling on top of problems. Things definitely were escalating. By 1864, it's when things get really bad. In this one occasion, in April of 1864, a group of government contractors were in charge of supplying beef to the army, claimed that some unidentified Indians stole some of their cattle. Local native tribes say they didn't. Some historians have claimed the herders may have lost some cattle due to carelessness and decided to blame it on Indians instead, rather than taking responsibility. Legendary American scout Kit Carson said that stuff like that happened a lot. The reality is, no one knows. Did some natives steal these cows? Didn't they? Who knows? What we do know is that this triggers a first fight between the Cheyenne and the Americans at Fremont's Orchard. In the version told by the military, a rancher had told them that his animals had been stolen by Cheyenne, so the soldiers went to recover them. The Cheyenne tell a very different story. They say that a group of dog soldiers, the dog soldiers were one of the Cheyenne warrior societies, these guys were on their way to raid their tribal enemies, the Crow tribe, and on their way they found 4 stray mules. That night, a white guy, an American guy, visited their camp, saying that those were his mules. The Cheyenne said, "Okay, we'll give them back, but give us a gift for having found them for you." The white guy said, "No, I'm not giving you anything," and instead he went to the army to complain. So this is the scenario. Either those 4 mules were stolen, which kind of could make sense given the context of starvation among the Cheyenne at this time, or the Cheyenne simply found them. But this wasn't exactly a reason for war yet. Lieutenant Dunn and this man arrive, found the Cheyenne, and Dunn approached them, inviting them to come to talk. The governor of Colorado, I mentioned earlier, Evans, had been screaming hysterically about how the war with the Cheyenne was coming and about the need to use an iron hand against them, so this probably affected Dunn's judgment a bit. They all shook hands with the soldiers, so it seems like it could go okay, you know, things were working out fine. Dunn demanded that the 4 mules were given back, with no compensation. It's a little tricky, you know, but it could still work. Maybe with some diplomatic tact the whole thing could still be worked out. You know, the Cheyenne were willing to give back the animals, but they wanted to get paid. Dunn said, "No, we're not paying you." You know, there's room for negotiation there. But what changed the dynamics of this encounter is that Dunn tried to take their weapons away. And this was interpreted as an act of aggression. So the Cheyenne ran off while shooting at the soldiers, and the soldier returned fire. So here, you know, these misunderstandings, I don't know if you can call it misunderstanding, I mean, these guys are, they are having a conversation, Dunn try to take their weapons away, these guys don't take it well, so a mini battle with few casualties on both sides is created by this. Of course, rumors start spreading far and wide. There, some of the rumors say that the same Cheyenne later killed the rancher, but when the soldiers go to look, they found no evidence that any of that happened. So fake news was alive and well in 1864, and it was stirring up fear and hysteria, which is what basically paved the way for the Sand Creek Massacre, as we're going to see. Which is why I'm always really Dan Carlin did a masterful episode of Hardcore History about how fear, in this case, he applied it to the context of the Cold War in the United States, about how fear tend to regularly lead to bad decision-making, and why it's so important to stay rational, even in the context where, you know, precisely because people are getting scared of something, that's the time when you need to stay as cool as humanly possible, because that's when bad decisions get made. This is definitely the case in this story. Believing that some natives had killed settlers, which turned out they didn't do, Major Jacob Downing captured a native guy, was part Lakota and part Cheyenne, and promptly tortured him to have him reveal the location of a camp. Later he had his soldiers attack a Cheyenne camp in Kansas, and he wrote, this is Downing writing, he wrote, "I believe now it is but the commencement of war with this tribe, which must result in their extermination." He also said, "I think and earnestly believe the Indians to be an obstacle to civilization and should be exterminated." Sound like a very final solution kind of idea was going through Downing's mind. Well, let's leave him to his genocidal fantasies for a second, but let's go back to, you know, here we have, regardless of Downing's words, Downing's action created, this was an attack against a camp that had not been conclusively tied to any murder or any crime or anything. So that's kind of a problem. So just 2 weeks later, a group of soldiers attacked another Cheyenne hunting camp in Kansas. The Cheyenne chief, Lean Bear, was a member of the Council of 44. He was a peace chief who had visited with Abraham Lincoln and had signed the Treaty of Fort Wise. He was You know, if you are looking for the Cheyenne most willing to compromise with the United States, you could probably do no better than Lean Bear. So much so that younger members of the tribe considered him way too ready to accommodate Americans. And this is one of the problems with this situation, you know, lacking an understanding of tribal politics. Many Americans assumed all the Cheyenne spoke with one voice. The reality was a bit more complicated. You know, among the Cheyenne there was a division between the Council of 44 pushing for peace and warrior societies such as the Dog Soldiers pushing for taking a stronger stance to defend their lands. Both of them made sense. Both of them had a good point for supporting the position they did. Unfortunately, the Cheyenne were stuck between two bad choices. The resistance that the Dog Soldiers advocated, well, as they say in Star Trek, that would be futile, since eventually the US could crush them. And accommodation wasn't really a very workable solution either, since it entailed giving up your whole economic system, political independence, and ultimately your lifestyle, in exchange for scraps, and typically no matter how much you are willing to compromise, eventually the United States would still want more a few years later. So both were terrible choices, and yet there were no others. It almost reminds me of the choices usually available in a US presidential election. Lean Bear understood there was tension, but he figured he could fix it. He was sure that the soldiers could distinguish between the Dog Soldiers who had fought at Fremont's Orchard in that first encounter and his own more peaceful group of Cheyenne. And just in case they couldn't, he approached the soldiers in a friendly way, showing the Peace Medal he had received directly from Abraham Lincoln, and an official document signed by President Lincoln stating that he was peaceful and friendly to white people. I mean, what better proof can you get than a document signed by the President of the United States, right? Problem was, the soldiers were animated by the shoot now, read later mindset, so they promptly gunned him down when he approached them. The rest of the Cheyenne got their weapons ready to fight, but another peace chief, that same black kettle I mentioned earlier, stopped them and, you know, started yelling at them, saying, "Don't fight, don't fight, don't fight," and this allowed the American troops to retreat. Lean Bear's brother was named Bull Bear, and he was more militant. He was a leader of the Dog Soldiers, and he was enraged by his more mellow brother's murder, and took it as confirmation that there could be no peace with white Americans. This is the moment when hostilities really intensify. On June 9 and 10, 1864, close to Box Elder Creek, which is east of Denver, some natives were there stealing cows from several ranches. And during those 2 days, they stole several cows, for sure, but they didn't really harm anyone. On the other hand, on June 11th, 1864, there was a brutal murder of the Hungate family. Husband, wife, and 2 kids, just southeast of Denver. There are several versions of what happened. No one knows for sure, but after researching all of them, the one I'm gonna present to you is the one that seems the most, offer the most plausible scenario. Why did this group of natives not molest anyone? I mean, don't get me wrong, they were stealing left and right, but they didn't harm anyone, they didn't shoot anybody or anything. However, they went with a vengeance after the Hungate. The prevailing theory is that Nathan Hungate shot someone who was trying to steal the horses, either wounding them or killing one of them, and that triggered a violent reaction. So on June 11th, this group of natives attacked the house, burned it, and killed the family as they fled. According to most native testimonies, this was not done by the Cheyenne, but by some people within the Arapaho tribe. Either way, this was completely unjustifiable. You know, one could find a way to justify the guys stealing cows, since their whole livelihood was being ruined, and they had to eat somehow. One could maybe also find a way to justify, you know, okay, so let's say I don't know if justify is the right word. Okay, we can understand why these guys were stealing cows. We can also understand why Nathan Hungate decided to shoot the guys who were stealing the cows. And I even can understand the next step, which is the killing of Nathan Hungate, because, you know, the Cheyenne were mad, they were getting shot at, they shot back. Okay, I get all of those passages. The passage where we're crossing a line is the killing of the Hungate's wife and the two little kids. You know, much in the same way as the massacres perpetrated by Americans against Native women and kids, or people who had not raised a hand against them, were completely unjustifiable. This one is also unjustifiable. You know, it's not that we don't play with different rules depending on who's doing the massacring. You know, regardless, it's pretty horrible. These grisly murders were music to the ears of the politicians who were hoping for nothing better than an excuse to fan the flames of war. The bodies of the Hungate were put on display in Denver, generating desire for revenge. Rumors started spreading the Cheyenne were planning a mass attack against the city, and for one day the whole city was caught up in full-on panic. You know, the rumor circulating was that thousands of Indians had been spotted and they were about to attack the city, so people all over Denver started nailing boards to the windows. You know, no one slept that night. Turns out that the thousands of natives about to attack were actually a bunch of cowboys moving cattle in the distance. But, you know, a rancher who saw them from afar, his fear made him interpret what he saw in a much different light. You know, none of it was true, but the fear was real. In June of 1864, Evans, the governor of Colorado, asked friendly Cheyenne and Arapaho to relocate next to the forts. Evans said, you know, the war is starting, so friendly Indians who don't want to get caught in the crossfire would have to go to these agencies. But he got impatient and didn't really give them enough time. You know, he didn't bother to let them know that he changed his mind, that the war had started. He said they had refused this offer, when the reality is that most of them hadn't even heard his offer. And some of them, who may have heard of it, were in the middle of the summer buffalo hunts and couldn't just drop everything on the spot. But, you know, none of this mattered to Evans, so Evans said that it was the duty of good citizens to go out and kill hostile Indians, and they could take from them anything as payment for their troubles. He called all to, I quote, do their duty for the defense of their homes and families. Defense of home and family. It's funny how the road to atrocities can start with something so wholesome. You know, countless evil things that have happened in history usually originate from seemingly the best motives. Create an equal society without poverty, and there you go with the millions of dead under communist regimes. Protect freedom and fight the evils of communism. There you get Milai and decades of bloodshed in Latin America. Same dynamics here in Colorado. You know, the next step for Evans was to recruit some extra militiamen for a few months. So enters onto our scene Mr. John Chivington. Chivington was a Methodist pastor. He had been very active against slavery, and had been fighting in the Civil War as major for the 1st Colorado Volunteers. He played an important role in the Battle of Glorieta Pass in New Mexico in 1862, cutting off a Confederate force that was trying to conquer all the land westward. What had happened was that General Sibley, a.k.a. the Walking Whiskey Keg — that's a great nickname. What's your nickname? The Walking Whiskey Keg. He planned to take New Mexico, the Colorado gold fields, and California, bringing gold and the way around the Union blockade on the coast. So Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederates, had approved the plan. And so the Colorado Volunteers were sent to block their path. Among them was Chivington and a couple of guys we'll be discussing soon: Edward Winkup and Silas Saul. On this occasion, these three had all fought on the same side and had fought Well, not only had they fought on the same side, they were successful. They stopped the Confederate advance. By our event, by the time 1864 is rolling around, Chivington had become the commander of the military district of Colorado. He had also high political hopes. He was hoping that this would lead to him gaining popularity and possibly running for office. He was under direct orders from Major General Samuel Ryan Curtis, who had said, I quote, "I want no peace until the Indians suffer more. No peace must be made without my direction." Chivington, we already know before 1864 that he had some issues going. You know, he had a few skeletons in his closet. There's lots of evidence indicating he had ordered his troops to carry out the murder of some robbers who he had captured. Also, both he and Governor Evans were thinking that a war against the Cheyenne may help their political careers. Things keep deteriorating from here on. In July, a group of Kiowa natives stole some horses from soldiers, and the Arapaho chief Left Hand offered to help them recover, but when he approached the soldiers, soldiers shot at him. They didn't kill him, but, you know, enough to get somebody else who was willing to make peace to change his mind. Major T.I. McKinney was a staff officer sent to Colorado by General Curtis to get a sense of what was going on, blamed Chivington's and others like him, because he said that these guys didn't differentiate between friendly and hostile. And he said, "These are people who, I quote, do not know one tribe from another and will kill anything in the shape of an Indian. It will require only a few more murders on the part of our troops to unite all these warlike tribes." That's what McKinney was saying. In early August, some of these gloomy predictions look like they are coming true. Around the border between, you know, both in Colorado, in Nebraska, right around that area, groups of Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Lakota people attacked and killed several settlers. And they also captured six women and kids and, you know, took them prisoners. This was exactly what Chivington was hoping for, so this gets him ready to attack. Now, also in August, shortly after this happened, the peace chief, the Cheyenne chief Black Kettle, sent a letter. You know, he had somebody else write it, because of course he couldn't write in English. He had somebody write this letter to Edward Winkup, the commander of Fort Lyon, requesting a meeting to discuss peace. Three Cheyenne, including a man named One Eye, approached the fort with the letter. Winkup had given orders to shoot on sight, but some of his men were not quite so trigger-happy, so they decided not to shoot and to instead bring this Cheyenne to Winkup, who at first was really mad. He asked, you know, he was mad with his soldiers who didn't shoot them. Then he asked this group of Cheyenne, why did they come? You know, didn't they realize they could have been shot? The Cheyenne replies was, it was worth it if you would bring peace, you know, and even if they were shot and killed, the letter would have been found on their bodies and may have brought peace anyway. In the letter, Black Kettle said that they had some white captives who had been traded to them by other tribes who had captured them, and Black Kettle was willing to let them go. This was a risky proposition because, you know, this invite by Black Kettle to go meet with him, of course, he smelled of a possible ambush. But Winkup decided to go anyway. He didn't want to risk the life of his men, so he didn't want to force anyone to follow him if they didn't want to, but he accepted volunteers. Over 100 soldiers volunteered, including another character I mentioned a little bit ago who's going to play a key role in our story, Silas Soule. All of these guys mounted their horses and went looking for the Cheyenne camps. Winkup told the three Cheyenne who had brought him the message that they would be killed if this turned out to be an ambush and the Cheyenne attacked. And one of them replied saying he was fine by him, since he had given his word and life without honor wasn't worth living. So if the Cheyenne attacked, by all means, do shoot me. This was a huge moment for Winko, because until now he had never really liked native peoples at all, but he was very impressed with these guys. He was kind of taken back by the seeming honor with which they carried themselves, their words, their action. So he decided to trust them. Together they found this Cheyenne camp in Kansas. And at first things didn't seem to go so well, since he and his men found themselves surrounded by nearly 800 warriors. But Black Kettle arrived onto the scene to smooth things over and, you know, agreed that, hey, what are you guys doing? Let's have a council. Let's sit down and have a council. At the council, Bull Bear, the same leader of the Dog Soldiers, and we mentioned him just a few minutes ago, he said that he had tried to live in peace with Americans, but he changed his mind after the soldiers had killed his brother, Lean Bear, who had been a peace chief. Others similarly stated that there was no way to make peace with Americans. One of the men who had brought the letter to Winkup and now rode back with him, One Eye, he spoke up and he was mad, saying, hey, I risk my life to invite this guy over here. And if the Cheyenne don't honor this and by any chance anybody try to attack him or his soldiers, he himself would fight on the side of the soldiers. Black Kettle, as, you know, tempers were flaring up among the Cheyenne, Black Kettle tried to smooth things out, saying that trouble had been created by bad men among the Americans and bad men among the Cheyenne, which is precisely the kind of nuanced view that could lead to peace, you know, acknowledging that, yes, some bad stuff had been done on both sides. Winkup told him that he didn't have the authority to negotiate a peace, but he would be happy to take him and some other leaders to meet with the governor of Colorado, and he argued that releasing the captives that they had in their hands would go a long way to start things on the right foot. So Black Kettle negotiated with some of the other people who had the captives in hand and negotiated their release. You know, these are the ones who have been captured in August by the Lakota and by some of the Dog Soldiers. And he managed to get them and release them into the custody of Winkup. Several of the other chiefs agreed to go to Denver to meet with Governor Evans and with Chivington. Problem was, Governor Evans had already decided for war. So he was not at all happy to hear about this, because he was planning for war, and he was afraid that if he made peace, people would be against him. Also, he was afraid that the federal government may be upset with him if he made peace, because he had asked them to finance a regiment of volunteers against by magnifying the hostility of the Cheyenne. And if now there was peace, they would think that he had exaggerated and misinterpreted the danger presented by the tribes, which was 100% correct. He had exaggerated it. But, you know, he wasn't about to admit it. So he said, regarding the volunteers, he said, they had been raised to kill Indians and they must kill Indians. Winkup couldn't believe it. He had achieved the impossible and brought a very real possibility for a diplomatic solution to the problem, and Evans didn't even want to give it a chance. Eventually, Evans very reluctantly agreed to the meeting. So a couple of Cheyenne leaders, including Black Kettle and White Antelope, met on September 28 with Evans. Black Kettle said he had worked to return the prisoners to show good faith. He was responding to Evans' previous invite for peace that had been sent out in June, but it had taken a while to gather different bands from his tribe, so that's why here they were now. Evans said it was too late for peace. Chivington sounded slightly more diplomatic. He said that maybe peace, you know, maybe we could have a peace if you turn in your weapons at Fort Lyon. So what Black Kettle understood was, if I bring my people close to Fort Lyon, then we can have peace. So there was a dangerous ambiguity in the meeting, you know. What each side walked away understanding was very different, but it was clear that Chivington had other plans. Regardless of what he told Black Kettle, his plans were something else. Because during a dinner with other officers shortly thereafter, he commented, and I quote, "I long to be wading in gore." You know, these are not exactly the words of a guy who wants a diplomatic solution. When Evans wrote the Commissioner of Indian Affairs about the meeting, the commissioner got really mad, feeling that Evans had not done enough to accept these peace offers from the Cheyenne. So Black Kettle joined with some Arapaho under the leadership of a man named Left Hand, and together they led this band of about 800 people to Fort Lyon. Winkup, who was still the commander at Fort Lyon, gave them food, and things seemed to working out okay. Author Duane Schultz wrote about this, I quote, "The Indians there would be under Winkup's protection, the protection of the American flag. The Indians knew it, Winkup knew it, Evans and Chivington knew it." However, what happens is that Winkup's superiors get mad because he was feeding the tribes and he was being now overly friendly with them in their estimate, so they replaced him with a new commander. You know, General Curtis appointed Major Scott Anthony as the new commander of Fort Lyon on November 2nd, because in his view the major would not be soft on the Indians like Winkup was. Which is funny when you consider that in one occasion Winkup had written, I quote, "My intention is to kill all Indians I may come across until I receive orders to the contrary from headquarters." So that's where Winkup was just a few weeks before. Not exactly the Indian lover. But as a result of his experiences, he had changed his mind. He realized, you know what, not these guys are not all bad. Some of them are actually good. We can have peace with them. And that's why he was changing his attitude. Ever since receiving Black Kettle's letter and interacting directly with the Cheyenne, Winkup had come to see the natives as humans and was willing to work with them to create peace. This was clearly intolerable to General Curtis, who promptly replaced him. Major Anthony, the new commander at Fort Lyon, told Black Kettle to camp 40 miles away at Sand Creek in southeastern Colorado, and that he would let them know if his superiors authorized him to make peace. Anthony had noticed that the tribes were starving, and so he had said that the government should either take care of them or let them starve. And he promptly went on to say that it would be easier to just let them starve, and that would be the easiest way to solve the problem. Clearly he was not very well schooled in human psychology, because as a general rule, people who are starving to death don't wait to starve sitting peacefully in a corner. Anthony initially asked the natives' camp near Fort Lyon to give up their weapons and consider themselves POWs. And the Cheyenne did that. But after 10 days, Anthony changed his mind. Again, author Duane Schultz, he released them as prisoners of war, returned their weapons, and recommended that they kill game to live on. He did this, he explained, because he had decided they were not dangerous. So let's remember that these guys we're talking about, Black Kettle's Cheyenne, you know, his particular band of Cheyenne, Black Kettle's followers, were overwhelmingly people who wanted peace. The Dog Soldiers, the more aggressive faction of the tribe, primarily responsible for the attacks against settlers, were not with him. Around this time, Chivington left Denver with his troops and headed out to Fort Lyon, getting there on November 28. A few miles from the fort, he ran into Silas Saul and asked where the Cheyenne were. Saul replied he knew where they were, but you know, there's nothing to worry about it. They are peaceful, and they are considered prisoners, and they are waiting to hear from General Curtis about what to do. One of the officers next to Chivington commented, "They won't be prisoner after we get there," and everyone laughed. Anthony welcomed Chivington inside the fort and said he was happy that he was there and he would have attacked the Indians already if he had enough men. And he also added that he was looking forward to join Chief Hinton in going against the Cheyenne. Silas Saul viewed things in a very different light. He met with some of the other lieutenants, Kramer and Baldwin in particular, who agreed with him that attacking the camp at Sun Creek would be a horrible idea. Now, before we proceed any further, let's talk a little bit about this guy, Silas Saul, since he's going to turn out to be one of the most important characters in our whole tale. Saul at this time was 26 years old, but he had already lived a rather eventful life. Saul had the reputation as a fun-loving daredevil, quite popular with the ladies. Before coming to Colorado in 1860 for the gold rush, he used to live in Kansas. His father had been a crusader against slavery, and Saul had joined his dad in being active in the Underground Railroad. I'm assuming most of you guys know what the Underground Railroad was, but just in case, it was a highly illegal operation set up by outlaw anti-slavery activists helping slaves to escape and hiding them at various stops on the way to Canada where slavery was illegal. In one occasion, Saul had broken out of jail an anti-slavery activist. So this is not the guy who, you know, is anti-slavery, meaning he makes some flowery speeches and says slavery is bad. This was a guy who, you know, his whole family, they were very active, even willing to break the law for the sake of fighting slavery. Saul had met John Brown after he was captured and was setting things up to break Brown out of jail, but Brown chose to die a martyr instead, telling Saul, don't bother, don't try. I'd rather go out this way. Saul was also friends with the renowned American poet Walt Whitman. He, just because his curriculum is not weird enough already, one of his ancestors had been on the Mayflower, or so the legend goes. Saul had joined the 1st Colorado Regiment for the Civil War and had fought in the Civil War, oddly enough, as we mentioned earlier, alongside the very same Chivington with whom now he was on a collision course. At this time, Saul was holding the rank of captain. So Chivington and Saul used to get along and actually be fairly nice to each other. Chivington considered Saul the best recruiting officer he had ever met, and in the past he had even recommended him for promotion. But now things were not looking good. You know, despite the previous friendship, well, I don't know if it's friendship, but still, they were looking at each other with, they were in good esteem with one another, if they were not outright friends. Saul now was really mad with Chivington, and he approached his own commanding officer, Anthony, about this plan about attacking the Cheyenne at Sun Creek. He was puzzled that Anthony had suddenly turned to much harsher after Chivington's arrival. He said, what you told the Cheyenne is not what you're telling Chivington now. Anthony told him, you know, don't worry about it, we're only going to go after the hostile Cheyenne, not those to whom we have promised safety, which would include Black Kettle's camp. Saul was still furious, and offered several other officers some choice words about anyone who would participate in attacking the Cheyenne. He said, I quote, any man would take part in the murder, knowing the circumstances as we did, was a low-lived, cowardly son of a bitch. This was the genesis of the clash between Saul and Chivington. A few officers agreed with Saul. They had been with Major Winkop when he had negotiated with Black Kettle back in September, so they knew the Cheyenne and Arapahoes were peaceful, and they believed they were at peace since Winkop had promised them. Kramer went to speak with Chivington and said that Winkop had given his word to Black Kettle, and so his officers, which would include Kramer, were also pledged. Plus, Black Kettle had saved them when they went out to see him with Winkop, and they got surrounded by 800 Cheyenne. It looked like things could get ugly, and instead Black Kettle had been true to his word and guaranteed their safety. So Kramer said, "I feel they are placing us in a very embarrassing circumstance by requiring us to fight the same Indians that saved our lives." According to Kramer, Chivington's reply was, "Damn any man who sympathizes with Indians. I've come to kill Indians and believe it is right and honorable to use any means under God's heavens to kill Indians. Kill and scalp all, big and little. Needs make lies." He also added that people like Kramer and Winkop should get out of the army. If they don't have the stomach for it, they don't belong. Others tried to dissuade Chivington, but received the same reply. So what's weird about this is that neither Kramer nor Soule would have had any problem with attacking the Cheyenne if Chivington had gone after the Dog soldiers who had been resisting American expansion. They were not, neither Kramer nor Soule, these guys were not pro-Indian in all situations. They just thought it was disgraceful to go after the same Cheyenne who had been working the hardest to create peace. Then again, fighting against the Dog soldiers was very risky business. These guys were ready for war. So considering that to Chivington all Indians were the same and all equally deserved to die, he clearly thought it wiser to go against those who were not ready to fight, rather than risk his scalp against those who were. Not that Chivington needed convincing when it came to killing Indians, but he also had orders from General Curtis, who had said, "Pursue everywhere and chastise the Cheyenne and Arapaho. Pay no attention to district lines. No presents must be made and no peace concluded without my consent." And on top of it all, Chivington was getting a little angsty because the term of enlistment for most of his volunteers was almost up. You know, with him he had some 700 men and 4 cannons, and he wanted to use them. Anthony told Soule he didn't have to ride with them, but Soule decided to go anyway, possibly to keep an eye on the situation. So after a night of riding, they found the village on November 29th at Sun Creek. There were roughly around 120 tipis there, more or less 600 Cheyenne, and a few Arapahos were there. The majority of the men were gone hunting, and at dawn, the soldier surrounded the village and took possession of the horse herd. Once the Cheyenne kind of got up from their sleep and in the dawn light they saw the soldiers surrounding the camp, they panicked. You know, panic spread throughout the village. The mixed blood George Bent was the son of a Cheyenne woman named Owl Woman, and was the daughter of the Sacred Arrow Keeper, who was a very important role within the tribe. And his father was a white man named William Bent, who had created a trading post in the area and had become a federal Indian agent. Bent was in camp visiting his Cheyenne relatives, and he said that when the natives saw the soldiers, they panicked because they were not expecting a fight. He also said, "When I looked toward the chief's lodge, I saw that Black Kettle had a large American flag up on a long lodge pole as a signal to the troop that the camp was friendly. Part of the people were rushing about the camp in great fear. All the time, Black Kettle kept calling out not to be frightened, that the camp was under protection and there was no danger. Then, suddenly the troops opened fire on this mass of men, women and children, and all began to scatter and run." So here we have Black Kettle flying an American flag with a white flag tied beneath it, as he had been advised to do by soldiers to let them know that he was peaceful in the past. You know, just in case, if you see soldiers, put up the American flag, the white flag, they'll know you're a friend. But the result was getting shot at. Another leader, White Antelope, he ran from the village toward the soldiers, holding his hands up and yelling not to shoot. He just stood there, showing he wasn't going to fight them. And he sang his death song, just in case things didn't work out. And the lyrics to his song, apparently in the Cheyenne language, went, "Nothing lives long, except the earth and the mountains. And sure enough, soldiers shot him dead. Several other natives walked toward the troops. Lieutenant Kramer said, "A great many started toward our lines with hands raised, as if begging for us to spare them." Two companies, Company D and Company K of the 1st Colorado Cavalry, roughly about 100 men, they were under Captain Silas Soule and Lieutenant Joseph Kramer. All of these troops refused to fire. Author Tom Bensing writes, "He had been a loyal soldier for 3 years now." He's speaking about Silas Soule. "He had been a loyal soldier for 3 years now. The troops under his command had received many commendations for their deportment and organization, and he fully understood the purpose of obedience in the chain of command. But as they approached the creek, he saw the situation for what it was. An out-of-control mob massacring men, women, and children, few of whom deserved it." So because of that, both Soule and Kramer are very loved by the Cheyenne and the Arapaho still to this day, because their decision not to fire made it possible for less people to be murdered. And they are the reason why several descendants of the survivors are even alive today. Lorraine Waters, a Northern Cheyenne, coordinator and instructor at Chief Dullknife College and a descendant of the survivors, said, "They were so honorable and so strong. But I felt they were alone, and sometimes when you want to do the right thing, the people that want to do the right thing suffer, even today." Keep this sentence in mind, because it will prove very prophetic for Silas Soule, and it will also apply to the Milai story that Daryl will tell you about. Mildred Red Cherries, also a Northern Cheyenne and also a descendant of the survivors, said, "I felt really proud of him. I was really glad there was somebody there who had a heart, that he wouldn't allow them to shoot us." Chivington didn't quite see it the same way. He would later write, "The conduct of Captain Silas Soule was at least ill-advised. He saying that he thanked God that he had killed no Indians, proving him more in sympathy with those Indians than with the whites." Chivington was very happy that his other soldiers didn't join those under the command of Kramer and Soule in not shooting, but instead enthusiastically opened fire on the Cheyenne, begging them to spare them. Cannons wreaked havoc in the village. In a letter written 2 weeks later to his former commander, Edward Winkop, Soule described the scene. "Hundreds of women and children were coming toward us, getting on their knees for mercy." Major Anthony's response to this was to shout, "Kill the sons of bitches." Soule, disgusted, took his soldiers away. He said, "It was hard to see little children on their knees, having their brains beat out by men professing to be civilized." Considering that few warriors were in the camp and the Cheyenne were caught unprepared, the natives couldn't really set up a particularly effective resistance. Some of them fled upstream and dug holes in the sand beneath the banks of the stream, and so some of the warriors used this to snipe back against the soldiers. The soldiers caught up to them and began shooting them. It really wasn't much of a battle. It was more of a straight-up massacre of mostly civilians. You know, things get really ugly. I'll skip on some of the details now because I'll get into the particulars once we look at the opposing accounts of what happened in the investigation that followed a few weeks later. A few days earlier, before the fight, Major Anthony had asked an interpreter and trapper named John Smith to visit the Cheyenne camp to find out how many were there and what was their attitude toward Americans. Smith had a Cheyenne wife and a half-Cheyenne son named Jack, so it was easy for him to mingle in the village. Going with him was a private from Company G named David Louderback and a teamster named Watson Clark. They were still in the Cheyenne camp on the morning of the 29th when they received the news that the soldiers had surrounded the camp. So Both Smith and Lauterbach put a white handkerchief on a stick and advanced toward the troops. They figured that these, plus the fact that they were dressed as soldiers, would make it easy for Chivington's men to recognize them. And recognize them they did, but it didn't help. When they were 150 yards away, soldiers began shooting at them, while someone yelled, "Shoot the old son of a bitch, he's no better than an Indian." A soldier named George Pierce saw this, so he rode his horse past the lines to rescue Smith, but he was shot down and killed, probably by his own men. Smith and Lauterbach had to flee back to the Cheyenne camp, and later in the course of the fight, Chivington saw them and ordered his soldiers to stop shooting at them and let them escape. Smith eventually arrived by the banks of the river where the Cheyenne were fleeing and reported what he saw. "I think I saw altogether some 70 dead bodies lying there, the greater portion women and children." By the time it was over, Chivington claimed that it was one, I quote, "one of the most bloody battles ever fought on the plains," and said they had attacked, I quote again, "one of the most powerful villages of the Cheyenne Nation." He also bragged to have killed somewhere between 500 and 600 warriors, while losing only 9 men. The reality wasn't even close to this. You know, most credible estimates range between about 130 and 170 killed, not warriors, overwhelmingly women and kids. His own losses were also more than he had advertised. You know, by the time an accurate count was done, initial report had indicated 10 soldiers killed and 38 wounded, but the final tally was about 24 of them killed and 52 wounded, many of them by friendly fire. Once the shooting stopped, the looting began. Soldiers walked in to plunder the teepees, take the horses. We start seeing a lot of the mutilation of the dead bodies of the natives, scalping, cutting off of fingers and ears in order to get the rings and earrings faster. White Antelope, the leader who had rushed to the soldier with his hands raised, pleading to stop firing, was scalped. His nose, ears, and testicles were also cut off. The testicles were used to make a tobacco pouch. Again, I'll postpone a discussion of the details until we look at the testimonies of what happened. Suffice to say, it was ugly. After the smoke cleared, Chivington's men came back and killed many of the wounded. They also scalped many of the dead, regardless of whether they were women, kids, or infants. Some of the soldiers wanted to kill, you know, they didn't have enough killing, so they wanted to kill John Smith's half-Cheyenne son, Jack Smith. Major Anthony would say, "I went to Colonel Chivington and told him that Jack Smith was a man he might make very useful to him, that he could be made a good guide or a scout for us. But," said I to him, "unless you give your man to understand that you want the man saved, he's going to be killed. He will be killed before tomorrow morning unless you give your man to understand that you don't want him killed." To which Chivington replied, "I've given my instructions. I've told my men not to take any prisoners." So after this, a soldier went to call John Smith out of the teepee where he had stayed in the night in order to draw him away. And while John Smith walked away, soldiers went in and murdered his son. Lauterbach went to Chivington to speak his mind about the murder. "I answered by saying that they had shot Jack Smith and I thought it was a damn shame the way they had killed him. Upon which some officer, I could not name him, I do not know what his name is, told me I'd better be careful I shot my mouth off around there about killing Indians. I told him I enlisted as a soldier and I considered my tongue my own, that I didn't consider that it belonged to the government, that I thought I could use it whenever I wanted. Sergeant Palmer of our company was standing near me at the time. He told me I'd better go down and stay with the company, or I would get shot yet before I left the village." Initially, it seems like Chivington thought about attacking the much larger Dog Soldier camp a few miles away, but eventually decided that fighting against actual warriors was not such a hot idea. You know, shooting fish in a barrel the way he did at Sand Creek was easier and safer. So instead, he directed his guys to turn around and return to Denver. There, they were welcomed as heroes. They had this whole big parade, waving around Indian scalps, severed limbs, and other souvenirs they took from the battlefield in front of the cheering crowds. It didn't take long, however, for reports to start surfacing, indicating that Sand Creek may have not been this glorious battle against the enemies of civilization, but rather a massacre of peaceful Indians. In the meantime, Chivington resigned his commission by January 4th. So this is where, you know, by this point, back in Washington, they began receiving letters from officials, including the Chief Justice of Colorado, Benjamin Hall, indicating that the Cheyenne had been peaceful and most of those killed were women and kids. So the government decided to open an investigation. When he heard what happened, Winkup was furious. He had just arranged a peace with these people, and now Chivington had gone out and massacred them. In a weird turnaround, the military authorities reinstated Winkup as commander at Fort Lyon, and he quickly began taking testimony from some of the participants. After gathering enough information, he sent a message to Washington referring to Chivington as, I quote, an inhuman monster, and submitted testimony to the Joint Committee of the Conduct of the War. And so basically several different investigations were conducted, two by the military and one by the Joint Committee of the Conduct on the Conduct of the War. In Denver, many people supported Chivington and were upset about hearing that these investigations were being done. For example, when Senator James Doolittle had a public meeting with Governor Evans in a theater in Denver to discuss what to do, he asked what he thought was a rhetorical question on whether the American government should help the natives on the reservation since they had taken away their livelihood, or just exterminate them. You know, in Doolittle's mind, the answer was obvious, you know, we need to help them out to make sure that we have no war and they have no cause to steal from us and, you know, all of that stuff. But instead, all the audience in the theater exploded in screams of exterminate them, exterminate them. Two editorials from the Rocky Mountain News by the end of 1864 confirmed this kind of feelings. They said, I quote, among the brilliant feats of arms in Indian warfare, the recent campaign of our Colorado volunteers will stand in history with few rivals, and none to exceed it in final results. All acquitted themselves well, and Colorado soldiers have again covered themselves with glory. Despite this, the investigations went forward. So there are several different issues that were controversial, that some people testified one way and Chivington's supporter testified another way. Chivington, for example, said that he had seen no white flag, no American flag, but Samuel Colley, the Indian agent, and John Smith both had said that black cattle had raised the American and white flags. Similarly, Robert Band said, when we came in sight of the camp, I saw the American flag waving and heard black cattle tell the Indians to stand around the flag. I also saw a white flag raised. These flags were in so conspicuous a position that they must have been seen. I'm just gonna quote a lot of material from the testimonies that were given in the course of the investigations. Here are a few regarding the killings that took place. Here is John Smith testifying. He said, all manner of depredations were inflicted on their persons, meaning the Cheyenne. They were scalped, their brains knocked out, them used their knives, ripped open women, clubbed little children, knocked them in the head with their guns, beat their brains out, mutilated their bodies. James Olney, lieutenant in the 1st Colorado Cavalry, told of seeing another lieutenant, Harry Richmond, of the 3rd Colorado Cavalry, approach some 8 prisoners, 5 were kids and 3 were women, and while they screamed for mercy, he killed and scalped them all. Here is Robert Band's testimony. He said, there were some 30 or 40 squaws collected in a hole for protection. They sent out a little girl about 6 years old with a white flag on a stick. The idea being that seeing a defenseless little girl, the soldiers wouldn't feel threatened and would be more willing to listen. She had not proceeded but a few steps when she was shot and killed. A 6-year-old girl with a white flag. Here are the words of a different witness. A group of soldiers paused amid the firing to take turns profaning the body of a comely young squaw, very dead. Someone had the notion that it would be artistic work to slice away the breasts of the Indian women. One breast was worn as a cap, another was seen stretched over the bow of a saddle. Amos Meech, Corporal, 1st Colorado Cavalry. Next morning after the battle, I saw a little boy covered up among the Indians in a trench, still alive. I saw a major in the 3rd Regiment take out his pistol and blow off the top of his head. And here is a testimony by Major Scott Anthony, who clearly not be reluctant to participate, so his words are extra heavier. Here is what he says. There was one little child, probably 3 years old, just big enough to walk through the sand. The Indians had gone ahead, and his little child was behind, following after them. The little fellow was perfectly naked, traveling in the sand. I saw one man get off his horse at a distance of about 75 yards and draw up his rifle and fire. He missed the child. Another man came up and said, "Let me try the son of a bitch, I can hit him." He got down off his horse, kneeled down, and fired at the little child, but he missed him. A third man came up, made a similar remark, and fired. And the little fellow dropped. Yeah, you heard right. Grown man in uniform using a 3-year-old for target practice. A volunteer named Robert Grant later testified that he saw one dead Indian mother, I quote, cut open with an unborn child lying by her side. I saw the body of a Cheyenne named White Antelope with the privates cut off. Silas Soule, in a letter to Winkope, said that the squaw's snatches were cut out for trophies. A woman was cut open and the child taken out of her and scalped. Again, Amos Meech, Corporal, 1st Colorado Cavalry. I saw some men unjointing fingers to get rings off and cutting off ears to get silver ornaments. I saw a party with the same major take up bodies that had been buried in the night to scalp them and take off ornaments. I saw a squaw with her head smashed in before she was killed. Next morning, after they were dead and stiff, these men pulled out the bodies of the squaws and pulled them open in an indecent manner. I heard men saying they had cut out the privates, but did not see it myself. I counted 123 dead bodies. I think not over 25 were full-grown men. Lieutenant James Cannon, 1st Lieutenant for the New Mexico Volunteers, described the mutilation of human genitalia by the soldier. He said, their bodies were mutilated in the most horrible manner. Men and women and children's privates cut out. I heard one man say that he had cut out a woman's private parts and had them for exhibition on a stick. I heard another man say that he had cut out the fingers of an Indian to get the rings off the hand. According to the best of my knowledge and belief, these atrocities that were committed were with knowledge of Chivington, and I do not know of his taking any measures to prevent them. I heard of one instance of a child a few months old being thrown in the feed box of a wagon, and after being carried some distance left on the ground to perish. I also heard of numerous instances in which men had cut out the private parts of females and stretched them over the saddle bows and wore them over their heads while riding in the ranks. Lauderback and R.W. Clark testified exactly the same way. In light of all this information, the panels investigating Sand Creek condemned the action in the harshest terms. The three principal guys that they went after as the bad guys in the story were Major Anthony, Governor Evans, and Chivington himself. Major Anthony said that he told the Cheyenne he couldn't promise them peace, but he had told them to camp at Sun Creek and he would let them know if he received permission from his superiors to sign a peace with them. He admitted under oath that he had continued Winkop policy, telling them to stay at Sun Creek until further instructions arrived. He said he didn't mind killing Indians at Sun Creek, but thought that it could bring retaliation from other Indians, so that was the only part that bothered him. And yet he participated. He tried to justify himself, saying he didn't approve of Chivington's attack in the camp, so he keeps switching back and forth, at seemingly, and the committee said of him, I quote, "The testimony of Major Anthony, who succeeded an officer disposed to treat these Indians with justice and humanity, is sufficient of itself to show how unprovoked and unwarranted was this massacre. He testifies that he found these Indians in the neighborhood of Fort Lyon when he assumed command of that post, that they professed their friendliness to the whites and their willingness to do whatever he demanded of them, that they delivered their arms up to him, that they went to and encamped upon the place designated by him, that they gave him information from time to time of acts of hostility were mediated by other and hostile bands, and in every way conducted themselves properly and peaceably." So they went on to note how Anthony, after all these, still joined Chivington in marching against the camp. Governor Evans' testimony was exactly what you expect from a politician. There was a long list of "I can't remember." He was evasive even about the most basic questions. The committee said of Evans that Evans' testimony was basically a shameful example of a politician trying to avoid responsibility. They condemned Evans, saying he was fully aware that the Indians massacred so brutally at Sun Creek were then and had been actuated by the most friendly feelings toward the whites, and had done all in their power to restrain those less friendly disposed. In regard to Chivington, the committee said the following: "As to Colonel Chivington, your committee can hardly find fitting terms to describe his conducts. Wearing the uniform of the United States, which should be the emblem of justice and humanity, holding the important position of commander of a military district, and therefore having the honor of the government to that extent in his keeping, he deliberately planned and executed a foul and dastardly massacre, which would have disgraced the veriest savage among those who were the victims of his cruelty. Having full knowledge of their friendly character, having himself been instrumental to some extent in placing them in their position of fanciest security, he took advantage of their inapprehension and defenseless condition to gratify the worst passions that ever coursed the heart of man. Whatever influence these may have had upon Colonel Chivington, the truth is that he surprised and murdered in cold blood the unsuspecting men, women, and children on Sun Creek, who had every reason to believe they were under the protection of the United States authorities, and then returned to Denver and boasted of the brave deed he and the men under his command had performed. In conclusion, your committee are of the opinion that, for the purpose of vindicating the cause of justice and upholding the honor of the nation, prompt and energetic measures should be at once taken to remove from office those who have thus disgraced the government by whom they are employed, and to punish as their crimes deserve those who have been guilty of these brutal and cowardly acts." However, despite the Joint Committee on the Conduct of War's recommendation, no charges were brought against those who committed the massacre. Chivington was beyond the reach of army justice since he had already resigned his commission. The closest thing to a punishment he suffered was the effective end of his political aspirations. Same thing went for Governor Evans. You know, the Secretary of State promptly told him to resign from office. So Sun Creek killed also his political career. But, you know, that's minor punishment for mass murder. Chivington justification. Well, let's look into his side of the story. His main argument was that the Cheyenne at Sun Creek were not peaceful. So he was asked for specific, you know, in which way were they not peaceful? Which ones of them would be responsible for what exactly? Chivington replied with no specifics, just with an idea of collective guilt, because they were all from the same tribe, so, you know, they must all be equally guilty. He also tried to justify himself by arguing Confederate agents were stirring up the tribes, thereby making Sun Creek part of the Civil War. Now, we are in complete fantasy land here. This is... And since this stuff wasn't going well, Chivington came up with a possible better justification. He said he had found fresh white scalps in camp at Sun Creek. Which, you know, that would be pretty hard evidence that these guys were not peaceful, that so he was justified in attacking them. First he said that he had, I quote, found a white man's scalp not more than 3 days old in one of the lodges. The problem with his story is that with each telling, the number of scalps increased. You know, his desperation to prove they were hostile. After enough retellings of the tale, now Chivington had 19 scalps of white people found. And even though the Cheyenne scalps were prominently displayed in Denver, these supposed white scalps were never shown in public. Possibly, and very likely, because they didn't exist except in Chivington's mind. Joseph Kramer said he went lodge to lodge and found no white scalps. Amos Miksch also said, I heard nothing of a fresh white scalp in the Indian camp until I saw it in the Dunn papers. Meaning, you know, nobody mentioned this at the time. It was only afterwards that somehow this story started gaining ground. Major Scott Anthony said, I heard a report some 20 days after the fight... Remember that, some 20 days after the fight, that a scalp 3 days old, a white woman's scalp, was found in the Cheyenne's camp. I did not hear anything about that until after Colonel Chivington had reached Denver. I was with him for 10 days after the fight and never heard a word about a white woman's scalp being found in camp until afterwards. This is Major Scott Anthony, a guy who's basically in bed with Chivington in this whole situation. Besides the scalp issue, Chivington had some of his guys testify that there was no white flag at the camp and that the natives had fired first. He also stated things that were provenly false, such as the counting of 450 dead bodies on the battlefield, which kind of discredits his entire testimony. Chivington himself said that they had killed 500 people but only saw one dead woman among them. They were all warriors. It, again, according to pretty much every testimony, that was a joke. Basically, Chivington's guys were saying that they didn't see any of the bad stuff, and, you know, the difference is that Chivington's guys were there covering their butts. You know, the other guys, the Silas Saul or even Major Anthony, these people had very little motive to lie since they had participated. So if the battle could be spun as some kind of heroic victory, they would also share in the glory. So it's pretty obvious who had an interest in twisting the truth here, and who did not. Some of Chivington's defenders didn't bother trying to justify it with the notion of self-defense, just openly embraced the ideology of racial extermination against all native people, hostile and peaceful alike. The Nebraska City News at the time wrote, it didn't matter if they were peaceful, and added, at present we are in favor of the Reverend Colonel Chivington and the religious extermination of the Indians generally. For the most part, most people didn't believe Chivington, you know, both most contemporaries and the vast majority of historians since then. Despite this, he still has some apologists. I mean, even in recent years, there was... Ruthenna Jacobs, who ran the Kiowa County Museums, she said, I'll quote, the colonel was just doing his duty. Now, some of his volunteers may have gotten a little bit out of hand, but that kind of thing happens in war. Yeah, you know, shooting 3-year-old kids in cold blood, that kind of thing happens in war. Generally, you know me in the previous podcast, I generally try to avoid getting into historical arguments. But I can't help it here, you know. You hear about fake news, well, there's apparently fake history too. The actions of some of the soldiers at Sand Creek are beyond horrific, but I'm at least as disgusted by the action of their contemporary apologists to this day. Now, admittedly, there are very few. The historical consensus of this issue is very much on the side that I presented, that this was a massacre and there's not much to it. Now, I can fully appreciate that there are obviously different ways to interpret history. I have zero problems with that. That's normal. That's fine that we may not all be in agreement about certain facts. But there's a difference between offering an alternative interpretation that's actually based on facts and just straight up twisting the historical record in a way that's really just designed to push an ideological agenda. I'm actually having to re-record this part that I'm about to present to you because I was mentioning names, and on second thoughts, I started thinking that sometimes bad publicity is still better than no publicity, and I don't really want to give these people any publicity, so I really want to go into some of the specific names. The point I'm trying to make, as I'm going to make it in the next few minutes, is just that there are quite a few, well, maybe not quite a few, but some authors out there who are published, who are not academic historians, because they would never cut it, but they are considered popular historians, get their books out there, and some of the things they write may be taken at face value from people who just haven't been exposed to the real facts. But what they are peddling is really just straight up fake history. In some cases, some of this stuff, it's a way to bring back some racist ideas, not even hiding it that well. No, I'm all completely against romanticizing the past. You know, when it comes to Native American history, quite a few people seem to embrace a Disneyfied version of history and like to paint all natives as peaceful, wonderful, spiritual, and in touch with nature. Of course, this is a distortion of the historical record. Natives were and are no different from other human beings, with all the flaws and good qualities that characterize other humans. So just to be clear, I am very much against romanticizing any culture. But there's a difference between refusing to romanticize the past and being a straight-up racist. The fact that one side twists the truth to drive a romanticized agenda doesn't mean it's a good idea to lie just as much to drive a racist agenda. It's like thinking that drinking a poison is the antidote to a different poison. It's not. It's still poison. You know, one of these books I read, which was published in the 1980s and very much defends Chivington, some of the language they use is, you know, they refer to the Cheyenne having their squalid villages, say that their teepee homes were filthy, explicitly refer to them as animals, and added sentences that are all about, you know, their grotesque designs of their tattoos, their pagan religion. You know, it has all this language that may not be racist in terms of skin color, is not somebody who hate them because of their ethnicity. It's more cultural racism. It's one of these guys who buys into the assumption, long discredited since the early 1900s, that there's a single culture worthy of respect and all others are trash. The way many of these authors play the game is that conveniently they don't mention all the cases that don't fit their agenda. So all the cases that we discuss in which the American side attack Cheyenne camps that were not hostiles, or other incidents that contributed to stir up the tension, they skip on every one of them. But never fail to mention the times when natives did something bad, either truly bad, like we mentioned quite a few cases before, or tweaking a self-serving interpretation of events that were perpetuated by those who were out hunting the tribes. Some of these books will repeat, almost verbatim, as if it was fact, some of Chivington's assertions, like that they found all these scalps in the Cheyenne camp, that, you know, things that... It's kind of funny to hear modern authors, again, few of them, but we hear some of them, take at face value Chivington's justification. When you consider that some of these justifications weren't even bought, even by some of the very warlike among his contemporaries, consider this, for example, just to give you an idea why I find this notion of taking some of Chivington's testimony at face value a joke. General Harney was one of the officers in the U.S. Army most active against American Indians. He stated, "I have worn the uniform of my country 55 years, and I know that Black Kettle was as good a friend of the United States as I am." Kit Carson, who had fought some brutal campaigns against some native tribes, said, "Just to think of that dog Chivington and his dirty hounds up at Sun Creek," he said to his army inspector, Colonel James Rasling, after returning from battle. He said, "His men shot down squaws and blew the brains out of little innocent children. You call such soldiers Christians and Indian savages? And what do you suppose our Heavenly Father, who made both them and us, think of these things? I tell you what, I don't like a hostile redskin any more than you do. And when they are hostile, I've fought them hard as any man. But I never yet drew bead on a squaw or a papoose," Indian child meaning, "and I despise the man who would. I've seen as much of them as any man living, and I can't help but pity them, right or wrong. They once owned this country, but now they own next to nothing, and will soon be gone." Along similar lines, Robert Utley. Robert Utley was, he's not exactly the historian with the most sympathetic views toward Indian causes, yet he considers Sun Creek an obvious massacre because, I quote, "Where non-combatants were killed deliberately and indiscriminately, I regard massacre as an appropriate term." It would be nice to dismiss the author I just mentioned, the one from the 1980s, as an isolated case, decades old by now. But there's another author who wrote a lot about the American West. He's a popular historian who, even in up in very recent year, in the 2000s, he has been publishing on the topic. And this guy, it's really terrible. It's terrible that stuff like this gets published because, you know, he says all the right things. When you listen to his interviews, it sounds perfect. He says he's approaching the topic with nuance, and nuance is a concept I very much love and respect. Unfortunately, it's simply not true. You know, Dan Carlin is nuance. This guy, under the guise of nuance, he presents just anti-Cheyenne, borderline racist arguments that have long been discredited. He started arguing these. He argued that all the peace chiefs were terrible people, that Silas Saul also, they were the villain of the story. And, you know, he makes it sound good by saying that he's just defending real history against political correctness, which again sounds good in theory, because political correctness is terrible. But really, this is just a cover to push straight-up lies. I mean, he repeats against all of Chivington's talking points, including the presence of scalps in the camp, which is unverified by any source other than Chivington's loyalist. Now, that's bad, but not as terrible when he uses quotes from a work of historical fiction, implying that they are actual quotes from Silas Saul. I mean, quoting as factual what are in fact fictional quotes, that's an F minus as an historian. I mean, he keeps emphasizing that his opponents are politically motivated and addicted to a PC version of history. Problem is, he's the one who, to me, blatantly twists the historical record for the sake of pushing an ideological agenda. You know, it's one of those cases of... I don't want to go on too long. I'll try to cap that quick, because this stuff really bugged me when I read it. Because the problem is, I see a lot of people who maybe don't know any better, who grab some books, take it as fact, when really it's painful how bad they distort the historical reality. In one occasion, he related some story about supposedly Silas Saul freeing prisoners under duress, quoting a book where the reality was that this episode didn't refer to Silas Saul, was referring to somebody else. You know, he also said that Saul had lied about not firing by clearly intentionally misreading his testimony, where Saul stated that Anthony gave the command to fire and then, quote-unquote, some firing occurred. That does not mean that he fired, and I think anybody with a third grade education would figure it out unless they are motivated by a political agenda. So this to me is, you know, cherry picking evidence to only include the evidence that fits a thesis that all natives were incredibly brutal, and ignore all evidence to the contrary. Regularly quoting sources that have been proven to be fabrications as long as they give him the ideological ammo he needs. And again, problem with this kind of work is that it may look legit to anyone who's not super familiar with the actual scholarship and existing evidence. But okay, I got it off my chest. Enough with the historical arguments. Let's look at some of the results of Sun Creek. Chivington said that when he started the campaign, he said that he would solve the Indian problem. But the reality is that he made things much worse. Governor Evans had been screaming about an Indian war that really didn't exist yet, but in a perfect case of self-fulfilling prophecy, he had now created one. You know, Chivington didn't pacify the Cheyenne by beating them. If anything, he obtained the opposite effect and radicalized the Cheyenne. Author Ari Kelman said, he's quoting George Bent, and he said, "Chivington," Bent explained, "had wrote with Sun Creek the very thing that the colonel claimed to have prevented, a conflict that threatened expansion in the West." Silas Saul similarly said, "Our best Indians were killed, because most of the people who were killed were pro-peace. And so because of attacking a friendly camp, the result of this is that this gave power to the war faction among the Cheyenne. 8 members of the Council of the 44 were killed, all of the ones were the most vocal peace chiefs. And the massacre, the reality is that it weakened the peace faction. So this convinced warrior societies like the Dog Soldiers that peace was impossible. So the result was that the net result was pushing lots of Cheyenne who had been either pro-peace or on the fence into joining the Dog Soldiers instead. George Bent and his brother Charles, for example, did exactly that. Or consider the story of this lady named Mochi, who's not the Japanese ice cream, different kind of mochi, her name. She was named Buffalo Calf. She was a 24-year-old woman who was in camp at Sun Creek. She said that during the course of the fighting, an American soldier had entered her teepee and had shot her mother in the head. And he had then tried to rape her, but she had managed to pick up her grandfather's rifle and shot him dead. After this, she became a warrior and fought as hard as she could for the next 11 years. Just a few weeks after Sun Creek, by December 30th, representatives from the Lakota, Arapaho, and Cheyenne tribes gathered together to smoke the war pipe and vow revenge. Many were met with black cattle, who had convinced so many people that they would be safe at Sun Creek. A black scout who had married among the natives, Jim Backward, visited this camp, suggesting, "Don't fight, there are too many white people, you know, it's not worth it." But in reply, one of the chiefs said, "We know it, but what do we want to live for? The white man has taken our country, killed all our game, was not satisfied with that, but killed our wives and children. Now, no peace. We want to go and meet our families in the spirit land. We loved the whites until we found out that they had lied to us and robbed us of what we had. Now we have raised the battle axe until death." So by early 1865, a coalition of Cheyenne and Lakota and Arapaho started raiding up and down Colorado. Some 50 settlers were killed, lots of property was lost in the process. You know, over time, this started a war that would cost over $30 million and resulted in countless deaths. Black cattle who had survived the massacre somehow still remained committed to peace, but his influence declined. Almost exactly 4 years later, Black Kettle was killed at the Washita by George Armstrong Custer's troops, and I tell that story in the first episode of the War of the Black Hills series. Senator James Doolittle, who had arrived as the head of a delegation trying to negotiate peace, he wrote to the Secretary of Interior, "It is that affair," meaning the Sun Creek Massacre, which has combined all the tribes against us. And why not? They were invited to place themselves under our protection. The sacred honor of our flag was violated, and unsuspecting women and children butchered, and their bodies horribly mutilated, and scenes enacted that a fiend should blush to record. So clearly this was a huge miscalculation, you know. But why did all this stuff happen? John Smith, when asked for why he believed the Sanskrit attack took place, he said, "I have heard that the whole Indian war had been brought on for selfish purposes. Colonel Chivington was running for Congress in Colorado, and I understand that he had his Indian war in view to retain himself and his troops in that country, and to carry out his electioneering purposes. Captain S.M. Robbins, who was a friend of Chivington, said that people had demanded an attack. They asked him, so during the testimony he was asked, even an attack against friendly Indians? And Robbins replied, I should say it would. They wanted some Indians killed, whether friendly or not. They did not stop long to inquire. So the blame on this story obviously falls on Chivington, sure. But at the same time, the destruction of the Cheyenne livelihood without providing a suitable replacement, you know, leaving them to starve on reservation, inevitably led to some, you know, Sun Creek was kind of the logical conclusion to that process. So yes, Chivington was, what he did was fairly horrible because he took it to its nastiest consequences, but the policies in place set the stage for it. Now, there are other tragic consequences of Sun Creek. Let's look at what happened to Silas Sol. If you are looking for heroic figures in history, you can do a lot worse than reading about Silas Sol. He knew that disobeying Chivington was a very dangerous move that could bring him little benefit and plenty of trouble. He did it anyway. He also knew that testifying as he did against Chivington, becoming the very first voice to speak in public against what happened at Sun Creek, was courting suicide. He did it anyway. Sol not only refused to participate, but became one of the main voices exposing Chivington's lies. His report is what led to the congressional investigation. Despite threats and pressure, he refused to bow down and chose to testify against Chivington, despite how dangerous this could be. He told Captain George Price that he expected Chivington's guys would try to kill him for his testimony, and would later try to blacken his reputation to discredit it. And things unfortunately would work out exactly as he had predicted. On the night of April 23, 1865, Silas Sol was with his wife. They just had married 3 weeks earlier. They were visiting friends in Denver when he heard gunshots, and he was in his duty as provost marshal, so he went to investigate. He was ambushed by Charles Squire and William Morrow. Both were soldiers in the 2nd Colorado Cavalry. Just as Sol had predicted, right after he was murdered, Chivington made his move to smear his reputation. He had one of his men provide testimony that Sol was a drunk, a coward, and a thief. Basically exactly what Sol had predicted would happen. Chivington also said that the mutilations of the bodies were done by Sol a few days after the battle just to put him in a bad light. He also tried to argue that the scalpings that were not done by Sol were done by dogs. I mean, this stuff went nowhere. After the killing of Sol, even many of Chivington's supporters in Denver changed their mind. At his funeral, people described Sol as fearless in the face of danger and death. Now, people often embellish things at funerals, not in Sol's case. Most of the city attended the funeral. Well, Chivington didn't. Squire was caught in New Mexico and brought back to Colorado by Lieutenant James Cannon. Cannon had also been at Sun Creek and had also testified against Chivington. When he was arrested, Squire had told Cannon he had no idea what he was getting into. He probably found out after he arrived in Denver, because Days later, Cannon died in his hotel room. There were no signs of violence. Many speculate that he had died because someone poisoned him. And maybe the same someone, or maybe a different one, also helped Squire's escape and was never caught. Squire family was very well connected politically, so, you know, the random mysterious death of Cannon and Squire escaping, all of that seemed to suggest something shady going on. Wynkoop believed that Chivington had hired Squire and the other guy to kill Saul. Chivington, after all, had publicly stated offering $500 to be used to kill Indians and their sympathizers. So the Saul murder was possibly under the orders of Chivington, possibly not. There's disagreement on that. In 2012, a memorial plaque was placed by the History Colorado Society on a building at the northwest corner of 15th and Arapahoe Streets in Denver. The plaque reads, "At this location on April 23, 1865, assassin shot and killed the 1st Colorado Cavalry officer, Captain Silas S. Saul. During the infamous Sand Creek Massacre on November 29, 1864, Saul had disobeyed orders by refusing to fire on Chief Black Kettle's peaceful Cheyenne and Arapahoe village. Later, at army hearings, Saul testified against his commander, Colonel John M. Chivington, detailing the atrocities committed by the troops at Sand Creek. His murderers were never brought to justice." On the other hand, the Cheyenne and Arapahoe still honor both Saul and Kramer to this day. On Thanksgiving, some of them ran from Sand Creek to the site of his murders and to the Riverside Cemetery, where they read the letters that Kramer and Saul had written about Sand Creek. Now that we're done with my half of the episode, be ready to check out the second half, to be released tomorrow, assuming that you're listening to this on the very first day, or it may already be out. So look for episode 32B, the part that Daryl is going to take you, Daryl Cooper is going to take you through another amazing story, pretty powerful and pretty heavy. And then we're going to sit back in the following episode and draw the conclusions from some of the stories that we're telling you. Daryl is a master, so don't skip on it. He's really an amazing storyteller. His series on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is just incredibly good. So, having said that, quick reminders. If you'd like to support my Patreon page, that's always appreciated. Link is in the episode notes. Also, let me say thank you to the sweet folks who are sponsoring this episode. Big thank you to the new CNN original series, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History, for sponsoring this episode. This series I just mentioned is a new six-part series narrated by Liam Neeson, and it links recent news events surrounding the Vatican to their unexpected historical origins in the Catholic Church. From the start of the papacy, to struggles with corruption, to the impossible challenges faced by wartime popes, we go inside the Vatican to explore the roles of popes throughout history, and how they spread Catholicism around the world. The series is going to air on Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern on CNN, and the premiere is on March 11th, so that's coming up soon, if you're listening to this episode as soon as it's released. I'm very much looking forward to it, because the stories of the Pope are just, you know, there's so much drama, there's so much intrigue, there's so many political developments, and really the history of Western Europe is intimately tied to the history of the papacy. Again, regardless of judgment call, regardless of what you think about the Catholic Church in whatever light, this is not about casting judgment of any kind, positive or negative that they may be. It's just the basic events are the kind of things that have shaped history in incredibly powerful fashion. So I know I'm going to be tuning in. Also, thank you to Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the leading meal kit delivery service in the US, and they are sponsoring History on Fire for the entirety of 2018. I seriously love their products. I mean, I'm always raving, and it sounds like, you know, of course this guy sponsor you, of course you're gonna be raving about them, that's what you have to do, right? Well, that feels, every time I say this stuff, it feels weird, because I actually feel that way. I'm not making it up. I'm not saying things I don't believe in. I am. Tomorrow, the new Blue Apron delivery is coming in, and I'm ridiculously excited about it, which is funny because I don't really get that excited about food. Well, apparently I do, because and not just because then producer and editor of History on Fire, Savannah M, is going to stop bugging me, asking me every 16 seconds, when is the next delivery coming? When is the next delivery coming? I'm like, don't worry, your food is getting here, it's okay. But also because I know that for the next few days I'm gonna be eating some amazing food. So, quite excited about that, but check them out. You know, you see for yourself if those recipes look good to you. What I would suggest to do is just go check out their website. Easiest thing you can do, and you see if that kind of food is what you want or not. I was hesitating about mentioning what foods are coming up in March, because I'm afraid that the second I'm gonna read some of these things, the salivating coming from Savannah M in the next room is gonna get too loud and disrupt the podcast, but, you know, we'll take that chance. Among the things coming up, there will be quick bucatini with broccoli and pecorino cheese, pan-fried chicken breast with sweet zucchini, Italian-style shrimp and sweet peppers over fregola sarda pasta, parmesan-crusted steaks with mashed potatoes and broccoli. I dig it. I'm looking forward to it. So, having said all that, I would like to remind you that Blue Apron is treating History on Fire listeners to $30 off your first order if you visit blueapron.com/onfire. So check out this week's menu and get your $30 off at blueapron.com/onfire. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Also, big thank you to a few other folks. Starting out with Mr. Mark Blanchett, who's the one person who has decided to sponsor History on Fire on Patreon at the $50 level. So part of the price for that is to have your name horribly mispronounced with an Italian accent at the end of the episode. Thank you, Mark. Much appreciated. Also, thank you to my regular sponsor, Onnit and Datsusara. If you want to check out Onnit, there's an automatic discount code if you go to onnit.com/history. Again, that's onnit.com/history. Just this week, I received from them some workout gear. I received some of their Alpha Brain, which I really, really like. I noticed that Alpha Brain, for me, I used to try the pills. Those ones weren't working as well for me. The stuff that really works well is Alpha Brain in powder form. And I noticed that it gives me the same level of alertness and sharp focus that come with like the best coffee you have ever had without getting jittery. So I really like it. When my brain is not firing off and I need something to help me focus, I really dig Alpha Brain quite a bit. So if you've never tried them, check them out. onnit.com/history. And speaking of check them out, if you are thinking of buying backpacks, or maybe you are a martial artist and you want to buy a new gi, Datsusara is like the paradise of hemp. Everything that's hemp made and high quality. They focus primarily on textiles, but they have a whole bunch of products. Check them out at dsgear.com and I promise you won't regret it. Having said all that, I would say also, of course, there's if you shop on Amazon, we are affiliated with Amazon, so there's an Amazon link on the History on Fire podcast website under the donate page. So check it out. Now, you have been listening to my heavy Italian accent for long enough, so I am going to officially shut up and wish you a wonderful day.